If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 72 of Pixel Sift. My name is Scott, and this week I will be hosting the show because Gianni is having a nice week off. I'm also joined by one of the newest members of Pixel Sift, Nick Byrne. How are you, Nick?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. Our guests on today's show are joining me from Sydney and the United Kingdom. Hello, Julian and Jay.
Hello.
The first thing we'll be looking at is the new Steam Direct system. Does it measure up to the now scrapped Greenlight program?
Yes, and finally, we'll be covering your right to repair. Do you really own it if you can't even repair it? Let's jump in.
Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sift.
No, seriously, Pixel Sift. No, seriously.
Pixel Sift.
So, Steam Greenlight was a tool that was actually launched back in August of 2012 that allowed indie developers and publishers to share information about their games to convince the community that their games should be granted entry into the Steam marketplace. But after 5 years, it's due to be replaced by a new system called Steam Direct.
That's it. And we're pretty close to it as well. It launches next week.
On June 13th.
That's it. And the most anticipated bit of it, I guess, was the fee for indie games joining in. It was said that it might be up to $5,000 or anywhere abouts, which obviously is pretty problematic for indie gamers and games, I guess, developers, etc. But they've announced that it's only going to be $100, which is very similar to the greenlit pricing, which is good for everybody. I think they did a bit of kind of, you know, user feedback and whatever and realized that that was just ridiculous. And as far as indie developers can't afford that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Especially it's so competitive now, like trying to get $5,000 back as well. You're going to need to have like a certain level of success to be able to do that. And then to make your own money back and cover the cost of making it and stuff. So it would definitely put a lot of people off.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty successful 5 years for Valve and Steam Greenlight, I feel. They've received more than 90 million votes from nearly 10 million Steam users, which on anybody's book is, you know, an amazing achievement.
It's something like 3.5 billion hours between players who have, played games that have come through the Greenlight system. So, it's definitely been successful.
Yeah.
I'd
like to think that their new setup and, you know, what they say is, you know, it being all about the opacity and making things open and clear and easier for the users. And what did they say when they were coining it? They were stepping out of the way and letting letting Steam do its thing. Mm. You know, we'll see how that works out.
But what is their argument then for like switching to Greenlight? Is it? I mean, what do you guys think is like actually behind it? Is it that they just kind of want to kind of get some quality control back in their own hands, or like why? What's the move behind here? Do you guys, what's your opinion?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Initially I was really worried about them being, you know, money hungry and grabbing for the cash when they were talking about those $5,000, bids that you had to put up. But now that it's $100 per game, I'm really not sure what their tactic is. I really feel like they're trying to improve their system.
Well, initially, actually, before Steam Greenlight was even a thing, Steam had a small team that handpicked games to go on the marketplace.
Right.
Mm. Okay, well, so it's like, Steam, they're still going to have to have an extra 30-day waiting period after the fee's paid, and then Valve will still, by person, you know, verify whether the game works and it's not malware, etc., etc. So, there's still going to be a small team working on it. But just not getting in the way of things as much.
I definitely think there's something that, like we were just discussing before, that it is a great way to promote your game and get a following. In the description that Steam has provided on the actual page, It does discuss like strategies that developers can do to promote their show, like several weeks beforehand, posting a page with relevant information and images. So it's obvious that they're still that they are worried about, especially I guess definitely indie developers losing that ability to promote their game.
Yeah.
So it is good to see that they are still trying to support the community in that regards.
Oh,
that's great.
What sort of specific parts of the Greenlight, through your experience, did you think that really were worthwhile and could do with following on into Steam Direct?
I would say... sorry, Julian, we keep doing this. Okay, all right. I would say, like, having that campaign page is brilliant because you have to, like, get a video together and then get screenshots. So, and then you have to explain the game and try and sell it. And that in itself is a really good exercise because it helps you with your design, kind of go, well, what is it that we're making here? Because a lot of the time you just kind of start making something and follow it. And it helps you, like, kind of think about it a lot and kind of force you to make a plan for the game as well. Like, it'll feature this, this, and this, and that's when it will be done. And, like, so that whole page and, like, getting people to comment on it, it's really hard not to kind of get excited about what you're doing and also at the same time, like, really hone in on what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, that's an interesting take, actually, because, yeah, you get so far along with your... You're caught up in making the game and the marketing, etc., but you actually wouldn't know how to sell it to a point, certain point, because it's just yours. You haven't had to sell it.
Definitely. What do you think, Julian?
I agree. I reckon, like, yeah, that's... what it was really good for, like, actually being like, who am I selling this game to? Because, like, I think we kind of didn't know who we were selling it for and stuff like that. I think I kind of liked that, like you know, the audience could vote on it and, you know, in theory, the best games are meant to get through. But, like, without any kind of, like, basically you're just saying, oh, yeah, I'll buy that in the future. Like, but you don't actually have to buy it in the future. Like, without that, like, people just, you know, vote on whatever and kind of,
yeah.
I think that's how some of these, like, crappier games got in. I mean, to be honest, I don't know, like, how we got through so quickly, like, looking back at our whole kind of video, because it was, like, it was pretty crap looking back at it. I think, like, the old game was, like, Flash, and it looked pretty amateur, really.
Well, thanks for a little bit of insight into the green light system of Yold, and we'll talk about your game very shortly in just a second.
Pixel Sieve!
It's not Pixel Sieve, it's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sieve!
Tuh. Pixel Sift has truly gone global this week because I'm being joined by Julian Wilton from Sydney and Jay Armstrong from the United Kingdom. Hey guys, again, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello.
I have to try and split up these questions between the two of you because we haven't got much success so far.
Julian gets number one, Jay gets number two.
We'll just call them like one that. And two.
One and two.
A and B. Everyone who might not have heard it, what is the Adventure Pals all about? And I'll leave this with whoever is you know, more capable of answering the gutty question.
I don't know who that is, but I'll take it. The Adventure Pals, so basically it's kind of this like quirky platformer game about this small boy and the kind of crazy adventures he goes on with his magical giraffe and his pet rock. The game story kind of revolves around you having to like rescue your papa that's been kidnapped by this evil dude because he's like trying to turn all the old people into hot dogs. So your kind of mission is to go save him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that sounds pretty great on every level. Now, I played the older version, Super Adventure Pals.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Oh, wow.
That's been old. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a few years ago, but I was surprised at how similar it looked and felt to the new Adventure Pals. Is it very much like a rejig or have you kind of taken things from the ground up and changed it all around?
I'd say it's like a reimagining. You know, when they keep coming out with new Spider-Mans, it's kind of that thing where you kind of take what you've learned from it and you decide that you're going to make something even better. I mean, if you compare the game side by side, once you play the actual finish, the Adventure Pals, there's like no comparison at all. Like the art is like on a, and animations on a completely different level. Like Julian's done an incredible job. And then also, like, there's so, it's so much deeper and it's bigger as well. There are more levels, but just everything that we've learned from all, everything that we've done, we've kind of put into this game and spent 2 years, like, of loads of love and loads of sort of all the insights we've learned and putting it into the game. So, like, it's similar in that it's the same characters and you have a, you know, you've got the giraffe and stuff, but it's a much deeper, like, fully realized kind of experience. It's a reboot, I guess, but it's a new game, leveled up.
I think, we basically just kind of looked back at the old game and we kind of like tried to figure out, okay, what was actually good about that and take out those elements and try to as Jay says, like just level those bits up, like focus completely on what actually made the game good in the first place.
And that's what it really feels like. It's really great. Instead of, you know, kind of scrapping it and trying to do something completely different, you've really grabbed onto what was great and ran with it. Really excited.
Yeah, I think the essence and the feeling you get from it is we tried to bottle that from the first game and bring it into this new one. So, like, in terms of, like, all the systems and, like, new collectibles and new sort of quests where like characters actually come with you on the levels and just even stuff like having the design so the characters more chunky so that it's clearer to see like where you're going to put your character and like so much has gone into design. But yeah, you're absolutely right, we went to the first one and we said like this just slaps a big dumb smile on your face when you're playing this game and it's just full of whimsy. Like, how, what were the things that made that work? How can we put it into like a little bottle and bring that into the new game?
And it really is so great. The artwork, especially, Nick and myself were commenting on it earlier.
I'm someone who was very young when Scribblenauts came out for the first time on Nintendo DS. And even Adventure Time, to a degree, I think there's something about that art style and almost that maturity that's hidden within the context.
Yeah.
It's just something that I think's definitely got my attention. That's something that as soon as I saw, because I have never actually seen Adventure Pals before until recently, and just immediately wanting to play that just for that sense almost that I get from these other things that I love.
No, it is. There's something about, you know, Adventure Time and that ilk. The animation and the style that you've used is really appealing on many levels to many different walks of people.
Exactly.
Something special about it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. I think, we definitely did try to, like, kind of go for that audience of, like, people that kind of like cartoon shows, but they're a bit older, but they kind of liken them for those, like, meanings. Kind of like the Pixar movies, how there's something for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily a kid's movie, but, like, kids are going to love it, and, you know, hopefully adults will too. And that's, like, a design principle with, like, really try to think about whenever we're kind of making decisions for the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Everything in the game is so appealing. It's amazing. I can't see it not popping off kind of thing in a fashion that Adventure Time has.
Thank you.
Especially with your faithful backpack giraffe.
Exactly. I mean,
filling that similar role to like the Banjo-Kazooie type thing.
Yeah,
definitely. That was definitely a big influence as well. It's kind of a bit like kind of Zelda 2 mashed with Banjo-Kazooie. Yeah. And that's kind of the form of, that the game takes. And then we slap that sort of Adventure Time, Steven Universe kind of cartoons for like every older people. But so like going back to what we were saying about the green light and like trying to work out who the game is for. I mean, originally it was just for us and we wanted to make something that we enjoyed making. But then thinking about it more and more, it was originally like much more like subversive, like more South Park-y, where we had like kind of rude jokes in there, and it was definitely squarely for like people like us who like those things. But we didn't anticipate how much like the bright visuals would attract younger audiences.
Yeah.
So that's actually something we've had to change. So we've taken out all the kind of dirty stuff. Oh, not that it was particularly bad or anything.
When did you realize kind of that your audience was changing? I know you did a Kickstarter and you received a good amount of backers. I believe it was about over 600, collecting over £22,000 in the end. So was it during the Kickstarter that you realized that your kind of audience was shifting?
Well, for me, it was more just taking the games to live shows and seeing who comes along. And it was definitely a lot of yeah, a lot of the younger kids, and we didn't expect that. So that kind of made us realize, like, well, there's this, you know, big group of people who want to play it. Let's not kick them out just for the sake of a bad pun. Like, let's kind of include everyone and take everyone along with us.
Yeah, so, definitely.
So the combination of an RPG and a platformer is not as common nowadays as it always has been. What kind of made you merge the two genres together?
Oh, I don't know, Jay.
I think it was when we first made the original Super Adventure Pals, a lot of it was kind of trying to mash as much stuff together, because we had, like, the whole thing kind of came from this feeling of, like, let's just throw anything in there that's cool, and let's make it as wacky and weird as possible and as full as personality. So I think it was just kind of like, okay, platforming, right? Okay, it would be great if you could level up. It'd be great if you could, how can we get, what's the point of going to these levels? And because there are a lot of platformers where it's just level after level and there's no story context. And I think when we added the towns and the people with personality as well, it added so much that we ran with it. So it was just a platformer, and then we wrapped it in this kind of story RPG thing, and all of a sudden we had a world, and I think that was really exciting for us, and that's what kind of makes up some of the whimsy of the game and its appeal.
Mm. So how did you guys form your team? How did you come together?
The internet.
The wonders of the internet.
Yeah.
That's how we got together.
Yeah, Jay. Jay and I think Jay, you did a post online looking for an artist. Was that right?
Newgrounds.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I saw his stuff, because Jay was, like, doing art as well. And I saw, one of his games. I was like, that looks amazing. I want to make something like that. And that was probably, what, like, 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago?
Yeah, crazy.
Been a long time, yeah.
That's interesting, having two developers in two majorly different kind of areas of the world. Does it help with your fan base at all? Do you have a stronger fan base in Australia or the UK?
I'm not sure. Yeah, it is actually really useful, though, because, like Jay can go exhibit in all the kind of UK areas, and I can kind of do Australia. So we kind of, we can kind of see more people without paying for the plane cost.
That's right. Like, you went to, recently you went to, was it the ANZ Awards?
I went to New Zealand for Play by Play Festival.
Play by Play Festival. And then I went to Comic-Con London. Like, we've been to so many, as Massive Monster, we've been to so many shows. We really hope that that's kind of, if it's definitely influenced the design, and hopefully it'll reach more people. But yeah, it's definitely good. And in terms of time zones, it sort of works, because Julian, you tend to be up a bit later. Maybe I'm a bit earlier. We actually work at the same time. It's just that it's like 2 a.m. for Julian when it's 10 a.m. for me. It's almost not noticeable. And the other guy in Massive Monster, he's in the UK, but he's not in the same city as me. So all three of us work remotely. So it's just kind of how we do things. Slack is amazing. We use Slack to kind of stay in touch and share everything.
Yeah, we use Slack. We love it. It's the best.
I felt Mitch just go.
Mitch just got so excited. Slack. All right. Well, Julian Wilson and Jay Armstrong, thank you very much for that. That's about all the time we have for that little interview. We'll jump into the next topic very quickly.
Thank you.
Watch episodes, let's plays, and more at youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
So we've all seen the videos online for the step-by-step instructions to replace your broken phone screen and thought, yeah, I could totally do that. Now, due to a ruling by the American Supreme Court, cracking open your console to fix it might be on its way to becoming a legal option. Hopefully, this will have a knock-on effect down here in Australia. But maybe not. Now, we are protected here in Australia by the ACCC, and that covers us for certain things as far as, get what you pay for sort of things. As far as getting into voiding warranties and everything like that, it gets really grey.
Very much so.
Very quickly. But as far as I understand, it's really weird. You find stuff on the internet that says one thing, and you find stuff that says another thing. As far as voiding your warranty, it's not probably not the best idea. But, you know, people are still doing it.
Definitely. As someone who has a lot of experience in the retail in the regards to hardware, seeing products come back and people having questions about replacing components and then what that does, especially in regards to gaming laptops, because you haven't built your own rig and you buy a gaming PC from one of the major distributors. I always got the question, oh, can I change the graphics card? Oh, can I change the processor? And I would have to say, sure, go for it, but you void your warranty. Just to, and it puts people in a position that is very difficult to deal with.
Exactly that. And this is where I guess the line stops, is that, you know, your products sold in Australia come with a consumer guarantee that it'll be of acceptable quality. But as soon as you start tampering with it, you know, that trust and surety goes out the window. I mean, as far as I understand, in Australia, if you buy something and as long as you don't mess with it to a point where you're going to stuff it up and it breaks on its own accord, they go through some kind of an investigative process to look into it. And to say, whether you stuffed it or not. And if you didn't, then you're up for a replacement. But if not, then it's, you know, suck eggs.
I think the biggest thing that comes out of this is, do we in fact actually own our products, or have we just been handed a license to use something we've paid a lot of money for?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, end user license agreements restrict kind of repairing options to places that the company deems authorized repair centers. So, like with Apple and whatever,
you have to go to the Apple centers to actually get your products repaired.
So, the reason we're talking about this at the moment is this is in obviously, as I said, it's in Nebraska, I believe. This case has gone down recently. No,
the Lexmark,
sure.
The printers, or the truck one. There's two.
No, Nebraska, the place in America. Thing between here and America. Between here and America, the things are kind of different. So, what are they covered by in America? It's called the 1975 Magnuson-Wast Warranty Act, and it's basically federal law that forbids blanket voiding of warranties on aftermarket repair. So, Americans have been going on thinking that, you know, they haven't been able to tamper with their things to fix it, but they have. They've been covered by this law for a good 30, almost like 40-ish years.
Yeah.
We do really need something like this in Australia.
Definitely.
Like, we need things above the basic right given to the straight-up purchase of things. Julian and Jay, I suppose specifically Jay from the UK, do you know how things are covered over there as far as this kind of right to repair goes with consoles and your own electronic software, hardware?
I think it's sounds very similar to the situation you have, where you need to kind of send it back to Microsoft directly or Sony to have them look at it. We don't have anywhere where, like you say, where you can take your phone and they'll repair your screen. We can't do that with consoles here either.
Nobody's ever really questioned, because they slap all those, you know, void if removed stickers on every screw and every bit that you need to click off. So everyone's just kind of scared into obeying.
Definitely.
Yeah. So it's like that Red Ring of Death thing with the Xbox. It was apparently, looking into it, it was a tiny, tiny repair that just took
nothing.
A few minutes.
Yeah.
But it would take, you know, weeks and weeks of people and a huge amount of trouble for the people who bought the systems.
Absolutely. And Sony had a similar thing with their, Yellow Lion or whatever it was. Very much around the same era, same problem. And but I think Xbox handled that situation a lot better. I believe Microsoft allowed a lot more people to kind of do things to it, whereas Sony were a lot more black and white.
Sony was very strange in the sense that if you changed any parts, if you changed a hard drive, or, you know, you did anything to tighten the CD holder, you voided your warranty. But at the exact same time, Sony on their forums and their help forums, they were posting how-to videos if you wanted to change your hard drive or you were trying to fix problems. And it was very confusing. And again, like when I was in the in working with retail, I was repairing my PS4 because it was spitting out the disc at me. And that was fine because Sony told me how to do it, but then I would have a customer come in and go, yo, this happened and I've tried this. And it's like, you just voided your warranty. Sorry. And it is a very strange and difficult position to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, like I said, as far as I understand it, if you can do what you want in Australia, but if in the process of opening or inspecting, you know, and they find out that you've damaged any goods by doing so, you're done.
Yeah.
Which is not so
I wonder
good.
If it's kind of to stop like corporate espionage, where you know, because if Microsoft employees then kind of open up a Sony PlayStation and they can sort of see all the secrets.
Reverse engineer it.
That was,
yeah.
Well, you know, this was a thing with the automotive industry years back, in Australia anyway, with exactly the same thing. You know, not everyone wants to go to the dealership to get their car serviced, but they needed the legit parts for third-party people. Mm. Eventually, it came around that, you know, anybody could do it, but it had to go through the courts and stuff. So, I wonder if this is a similar thing that will happen through electronics and open up the way for kind of, you know, user play.
Because it has happened in the past where third-party parties have copped copyright and theft suit, lawsuits, basically. Because
what do you think about it personally, Nick?
What do I think about it?
As someone who's worked in retail and has had to deal with both sides of this, what's your stance?
If you buy a product and you wish to change something, you should be allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you go in there and say you break wires or something, if you are, then you voided your warranty. You shouldn't be able to go to the, especially the, because it puts the retailer in a position where they're like, oh, you've made the mistake and it is within your right, but now I have to cop out several $1,000s mm-hmm. to replace your product. And it's a huge difference between going to a retailer and then just getting a product directly from a company. So my MacBook, for example, I can go to Apple and say, this happened, I haven't done anything, please change it over. They check it out, everything's fine. But if you go to a retailer and go, look, this is weird, I have no idea what's going on, they have to spend several weeks dealing with the distributor. They're getting yelled at by the distributor for not knowing what's going on, and the customer's hating them for not fixing the problem. And it puts everyone in a bad position. And it also actually takes a lot of power away from the buyer. Because they're not in control of what's happening to their product and the repair.
To be fair, yes. If you're going to get your stuff repaired, especially electronics, going to a retail shop is probably the last place you would want to go for quick and efficient service.
Very true.
But, you know, we learn from our mistakes. Mm. Unfortunately, that is about all the time we have for today's show. And we didn't do it a little bit earlier, so I'll get Julian and Jay to give Adventure Pals and Massive Monster a bit of a spruik. Boys, if people want to get involved, if they want to check it out, where can they go? Where should they go?
Twitter.com/sapgiraffe. Otherwise, we've got theadventurepals.com. Hit us up and get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. And look out for the Adventure Pals coming out later this summer. Xbox, PlayStation, and Steam, PC and Mac.
Yeah, it's wicked. Really, ooh, do check it out. It looks great. And thanks again for joining us, everybody, on Pixel Sift. We hope you've enjoyed the show. As usual, we'll be putting up links on our website, which is www.pixelsift.com.au.
You can also find us on social media at facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and finally youtube.com/pixelsift.
That's it. And Nick, also, if people want to listen to other episodes, where should they go?
Go to our website to stream episodes, subscribe as a podcast either on Apple Podcasts, Pocket Cast, or using the RSS link on our page. And if you're listening to us exclusively on one of these platforms, I just want to remind you that we go live every fortnight. Our next episode will be on the 8th of June.
Well, that's not quite right. It's today is the 8th of June.
Oh,
yes.
Whoops. Oh, yeah. My bad.
I forgot to change that in the script.
While you're on Apple Podcasts, if you could just give us a review and star rating, that would really help other people find our show. Or even better, if you know someone who would like to the show, grab their phone and subscribe them to Pixel Sift. If you like what you've been listening to, make sure to tell all your friends as well. Thanks again.
22nd. Next show is on the 22nd.
The next show is on the 22nd.
Sorry about that, guys.
Thank you to Julian and Jay.
Thanks, guys.
Peace
out.
Thank
you.
Thank you. Have a good
day. Great. Thanks.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.